I'm going to try and go through what we've got in Lesson 45 in the book. If you didn't get a copy of the questions for Lesson 45 that are outside the book, then there's a few more up here. I think I printed off 20 of them. So, and if you're on my email list, you would have gotten it early last night. So I wanted to look at a few things, and essentially what I want to do is go through Lesson 45 and look at our main headers that we have on there. So, for example, as near as I can tell by reading through the first part of Lesson 45, this is essentially what Mickey has covered. And then we've looked at perhaps some of the things, like on page 178 that say early problems, and then on page 179 about early persecutions, and then on page 180 about the fullness of time. So there's things there that I just wanted us to look at and see if there were some things worth discussing in there. Once again, I wanted to bring us back to where we are. Well, I've already zoomed into Bible lands, but remember that we're over here on the Eastern Hemisphere. And, of course, the area that we're looking at is much smaller than what we're used to here in the United States. The United States, of course, covers a major portion of the Western Hemisphere, whereas what we're looking at now is just what I call the Bible lands, which in greater detail is just really this area right in here. As far as the vast majority of the discussion that we have throughout perhaps a good portion of the Old Testament and a fair portion of the New Testament. That's all we cover. But you'll remember as we talked about this previously, you remember that we sort of zoomed out here also because it appeared that things got a little more global as history went along, and Egypt became more involved. Egypt became more involved in things, and then we see that the kingdom. The United Kingdom of Israel, of course, it took possession of lands all the way down to somewhat into the Sinai Peninsula here and all the way up to the Euphrates River, which is way up here. But when we talk about, though, the people of Israel, where did they mostly live? They lived in this area that we've discussed, you know, in great detail. There wasn't a lot of immigration to other places. Oh, I'd like to go live by the Euphrates River or something like that. It was, no, everybody kind of stayed right there. And so even when King David or King Solomon at their greatest power had control of the land all the way up to the Euphrates River, there really weren't any Jewish people to speak of living in that area. There might have been other peoples in that area, but none of the people at whom you might say the Bible story is aimed, as it were. Yeah, Joey.
It's really no surprise that people just have a whole lot of incentive to leave that area because that land has historically been so special to them.
It has been.
The phrase of the Holy Land.
Right.
And all the rich history and culture associated with that particular spot.
Yeah, it was probably one of the descriptions they had of the land was a land flowing with milk and honey, right? And they'd come from 400 years here in Egypt, and perhaps they were up here in the Nile Delta where it was somewhat fertile, but they were being persecuted and such alike as that. So they were going into a land here that was different from what they'd had before, and it was really going to be good for them. James, you had your hand up.
Yeah, you know, really, until I think it was Assyria, who when they came in and conquered people, they scattered them. You know, until then, the borders we find, I think it's Genesis 15 or Genesis 18, that's really where they stayed. They stayed in the borders of the land that God gave them.
Right, right. And we see no actual voluntary emigration of any size or of any note at all in the Old Testament. The only immigrations we have are forced immigrations. And so it's interesting to note that though the scope of the Bible, as it were, expands, the people, the area that the people are in doesn't expand. Now, as we went further on, we realized that all of a sudden the scope of the Bible story is taking in much bigger areas now as we talk about Assyria and Babylon and the Medo-Persian Empire. Then later on, after the Medo-Persian Empire, the Grecian Empire. And then after that, the Roman Empire. So we see there that the Bible story sort of expands all the way over here to the Indus River and all the way over here, essentially, almost to Italy. I think the Greeks, you know, tried to take some areas up in there. And maybe if I move this down a bit, we'd be able to see some of the area actually we were actually talking about. It's much more global now as far as the Bible story goes. But that's because the people that were in this little area right here have now been taken away to Assyrian captivity, to Babylonian captivity, and other people, at least by the Assyrians, have been brought down here and placed in the land of Israel. What did they later become called? The Samaritans, that's correct. So, they were people, they were foreign people, displaced other people that had been conquered. And so they were placed here in this land because the Assyrians knew that they would stay under their thumb, as it were, and they were just content to obey the Assyrians, as it were. And whatever people that were left in Israel of the Jewish people, of course, it appeared from many of the accounts that we have in the Bible, they intermarried and they did things that they were forbidden to do, and so these people became a really mixed people. Joey?
Do we really understand today why there was such an animosity between the Israelites and the Samaritans? I mean, was it kind of like, hey, we don't want you here on our land, or did it go much farther than that? Were there other reasons why there was this kind of resentment?
The resentment between the Jews and Samaritan, I think, has several points. I think some of it is the fact that these are foreigners, essentially, is what it is. At least that's how they started off. The Jews, of course, throughout their history, had been admonished not to mingle with foreigners, not to interface with them. And it appeared that from some of the discussions that you see in the Bible in the Old Testament, that just to interface at all with foreigners was rather distasteful to Israelites. James,
let me... Part of that problem was pride, like, we're God's chosen people and you're not? Or...
And I think we see that as we get into this lesson, into the New Testament lesson, and why they failed to recognize Jesus as the Messiah, is because it didn't fit their plan. James?
When we study Nehemiah, we know with Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem that a great deal of that was political, and one of the ways that they tried to cramp Nehemiah's style was by writing the king saying, look, he's going to come down here, he's rebuilding this wall, and they're going to rebuild everything, and this is going to take your power away, and this is all ours. So there was definitely a big political aspect of it, but in Romans, I think it's 2, Paul wrote that the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of the Jews. So the Jews had this higher and mightier attitude about, well, look, God spoke directly to us. He's our God. You people are nothing. So there was definitely a lot of snobbery in the air that pushed the Gentiles away. So you just got a recipe for all kinds of problems.
Well, and when we look at some of the prophecies from the Old Testament, we see that God warns them time after time. As a matter of fact, in my daily reading, I'm reading through Jeremiah right now. Of course, there's a lot of discussion there with Jeremiah about the right way to do things and the wrong way to do things. But Jeremiah, some of the prophecies that he has, God tells him that this Jerusalem is going to become desolate. It's going to become, you know, a place for ostriches to lay. It's going to be burnt. It's going to be all of this stuff. And they just don't want to hear it. He says, God says specifically, don't go down to Egypt. What do? They go down to Egypt. They seem to have a tough time obeying God's word, yet, as you say, they feel that they're God's only chosen people. Well, certainly at one time they were, but they brought this upon themselves, you might say.
Right.
Okay, Jackie?
No, I think the word chosen there is a loaded word, and it caused them to misunderstand what it really meant. Chosen means that God set them aside for a particular purpose. It doesn't mean that God favored them because he thought they were better.
True, that's right.
So if you don't carefully define what we mean by chosen, you can easily go astray here.
Right.
Right. Wrong idea.
God chose you for his reasons.
Yes.
Not because, as you say, not because you're...
He loves you more or he thinks you're better.
Yeah. Mom loves you more. Right, yeah. So, yeah, that wasn't it. James?
Well, yeah, and we see that, I think, in Genesis 15 with Melchizedek. We know that the Gentiles did, even that far back, they had priests. They had communication, some form or another, with God. So they're created in his image as well. He loved them. He provided something for them. But biblically speaking, we're concerned with the Jews primarily because it's through them that he brought his son into the world. But
right.
That doesn't mean that he left the Gentiles out there to hang with nothing until Christ. They did have something. And it's after that system of priesthood with Melchizedek that Christ's priesthood is patterned after, because he couldn't be a priest under the old law.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's... I was in a discussion with somebody once. He said, are you telling me that Christ couldn't be a priest under the old law? Yeah. and so he discounted everything that we had to say simply because we said that Christ couldn't be a priest under the old law. He's not of the right tribe. He's from the tribe of Judah. You know? So it's like, okay, well, I guess we'll just read the Bible any way we like to. It appears that's what a lot of people do. But anyway, my overall thought was is that what we've done in examining the Bible story is to focus in on this area, and then slowly we've pulled out to a greater worldview by the time we get to the area that we're in now. And now if we pull out just a little bit further and take the whole Mediterranean area, we realize that, and you've got a map on page 168 or 172. It's here at the bottom of my file. 162. I had it backwards. 162 is called the Roman Empire in the days of Christ. And you remember that we had talked about this some the last time that I was teaching this class, and that the fact of the matter is, now that the Roman Empire is in charge, now this whole area around the Mediterranean is part of the Roman Empire. Some more than others. I mean, it goes up into Gaul and Spain, things like that. Other areas that they went at least 50 miles inland, their power. That's interesting. I just note that this area right here is shown as not part of the Roman Empire, probably because nobody wants it. But so I don't know what's down there right now. The other side of the Rock of Gibraltar, I don't know what's on the other side of that right now. So so now our view's gotten really global. But then we jump into the New Testament and start looking at what's going on, and now our view is getting less global, at least for a while, and we're back here in this area for... All right, I'll make you dizzy here. We're back here in this area for a while here, at least for the Gospels, right? That everything takes place in essentially where we started off. Actually, most of it takes place up here in the area of Galilee. as far as the ministry of Jesus and things like that goes. So once again, we've gotten to a more localized view. But then, once Acts chapter 2 comes around, what happens? All of a sudden, we start zooming out again. Now, all of a sudden, we're looking at people in Acts chapter 2 that, if we go to the PowerPoint presentation on that, that's got all the little circles and lines and dots and stuff on it. Oops, that's the wrong one. This one right here. We realize that when in Acts chapter 2, where it talks about all the people that were there in Jerusalem for Pentecost, that they're coming from all over this Roman Empire. Notice once again, we've got the map. This is like on one whatever it was. It's like on 162. It's essentially the same map showing the control of Rome around the Mediterranean area. And we realize that the people that were here in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost were from all over this Roman Empire. Now, though we zoomed in real quick in the Gospels, back to where we had started off originally, now all of a sudden, boom, we're back out into a global realm. And as the Gospel starts going around, we realize that now, all of a sudden, we're going to be able to back this thing out and look at the entire world. One of the instructions in the lesson book was, or the discussions in the lesson book was about the Ethiopian eunuch. So he was from Ethiopia, of all places, which is down here, well south of Egypt. And so they said one of the things that you should do on your map is draw an arrow down here saying Ethiopia that way. And but one of the comments that they make is that it's a well-known fact that Ethiopia was a sort of bastion of early Christianity. I hate to use the word Christianity because that's not a biblical term, but it was an early center of that, probably caused by the fact that this Ethiopian was converted on his way back home and talked to other people about it. But if you go and look in secular books and things like that, and look at the community in Ethiopia of people that claim to be Christians, you will see that they popped up about at the same time that everybody else did way up here. And so there's this big old gap, you know, between Egypt and Ethiopia, where now all of a sudden there's Christians. And that's an interesting thing to look at from a sort of a, I guess you call it a secular point of view. But but if you look that up, you'll find that that's the case. So now, once again, we have gotten into a global realm here, and it's much bigger now than it was before. Ethiopia's, I don't know, it's down here somewhere. I guess if I turn my my place names on, we'd find it. But anyway, it's down there in the desert somewhere. Kind of like Lancaster, where nobody wants to live. Bruce.
You know, that really amazed me that you made that statement. You know, when you look at where Jerusalem is, mm-hmm. and then you look at, you know, way over in Spain, and then up in the green areas, it kind of makes you wonder, you know, well, God knew exactly what he was doing, because the gospel really spread in those areas we were talking about. But what about those green areas? The travel, you know, was the art of travel and all that, you know? Was the gospel going to spread, you know, with all of that?
Those green areas have a lot of snow. You don't want to go there. Anyway, why do we suppose, I mean, if we think about it in our think-sos, why do you suppose that God started here to spread the gospel?
It's the center of the wheel, basically.
It is. It's also the center of what? It's the center of a bunch of trade routes, is it not? And so they had the... they had the ability to cease trade, as it were, with people, or control the trade, or tax the trade, or all sorts of things. So for a while, this area certainly was an area of power. And it could control what went on in the rest of the world until the Phoenicians really kicked off their navy, and then, of course, the Greeks, their navy was more, I think, a little more local than you know, seagoing type thing. But the Romans, when they finally started going, they finally had a seagoing navy of sorts. You know, nothing like what we've got, but apparently they were pretty efficient at what they were doing. And so, really, we had a choke point here. If you wanted to get anywhere from this continent to this continent, you essentially had to go through here, if you were coming from here or coming from there. Now, if you come from over here, you could go somewhere else, but you know, that's tough terrain over there, too.
So travel would be a lot easier in those areas.
That's right. So, perhaps one of the reasons, then, that we see that the gospel starts spreading from Jerusalem, as was prophesied in, was it Isaiah 2, right? Is that this is a great place for it to branch out from. People will naturally go through it, or from it, or to it. Of course, we realize that in the discussion about all the little circles we had of all the people that were there from Acts 2, that all people kind of flooded to it. One of the points that they make in the lesson book is that as things got more modern, of course, we look at them and we think how primitive they are. But you need to think of the fact that if we look back 1,000 years, you might say, before Jesus' time, that things were much more primitive as far as they were concerned. And now they consider, the people of Jesus considered themselves to be the modern people. And then those primitive people of 1,000 years ago, you know, they couldn't do anything. So, but we realize that, as is mentioned in the book, that a young man from Tarsus, you know, came all the way down here and had his training in the city of Jerusalem at the feet of Gamaliel. We see that all those people from all these different areas that we had circles of, they came down here to Jerusalem for the Feast of Pentecost. So it appears that travel was much more available or reasonable or something to them at that time. And people traveled a lot longer. You'll remember when we discussed about the people returning from Babylonian captivity down to here. So they had this distance to go. How long did we figure it took them to go that far? Isn't it 3 or 4 months? I mean, obviously they had a big party with them. They probably had children and cows and wagons and things like that. But in this short, as far as we're concerned, in this short distance right here, it took them like 3 or 4 months to get there. Now, I don't know that they had any better or quicker transportation at this time, but apparently people were more worldly minded by the time the New Testament comes around, that they knew more about their world. There were still probably the vast majority of people that lived here in Israel that, as the book says, never traveled more than 10 miles from their home, from the place where they were born. And we see that here, even in the rural United States, just within the last, say, 50 years, that was the case with many people, that many people had never been outside the county in which they were born. Now, of course, we consider ourselves modern people, and we're just all over the place. So I'm sure, though, some of these people consider themselves to be modern people, and they were all over the place, too. So they took the time to come to these feasts in Jerusalem. Ma'am?
Whenever you have travel, and you have word of mouth going out all
about. Right, so right.
That's very much as industry and trade.
Mm-hmm.
You also get people spreading.
Yeah, people talking. And I think that's one of the reasons why down here in wherever Ethiopia is, it became such a center of Christians, because that Ethiopian went down there and talked to people. The only reasonable explanation anybody could come to. James?
You know, look at how Jews could have traveled in New Testament times during the Roman Empire, with Paul going before Felix and Festus and Agrippa and up to Caesar himself. No doubt many people in the Roman Empire had heard about this Paul guy from down in Palestine, who's all the way up here on trial for preaching some new religion.
Yep.
So no doubt God used that as a medium to get that word spread. And we know there were even some in Caesar's household who heard the truth and became members of the church. The book of Romans, I think it is, gives us some insight into that. So they didn't have Facebook and Twitter back then. The news sure spread fast.
Yeah, it did. You know, because as Donna was saying and James was saying, you know, people went out from here after they had done, and they carried the word. That's how they got news back in those days. You'll remember this in several instances in the New Testament. They asked Paul and Barnabas or Paul and Silas, you know, do you have anything to say? Well, some of that was, you got any news from abroad? When Paul went up and talked to, what was it, the people in Rome? They said, well, we haven't heard anything said about you, you know. So he was there to bring them the news first. So nobody had gotten up to Rome to say what a bad person Paul was, or to say what a terrible sect this sect of the Christians was. But so Paul essentially had first bat there. And so, but, you know, they said, well, we're interested in hearing what you have to say. So they would get together and they would discuss the news. Yeah, since apparently, as you say, they didn't have Twitter, which is just unbelievable. So, yeah. So God chose this area for, of course, for His reasons, and it appears to be a very logical area for things to then just spiral out, which is exactly what it did, and we can see that. There was one point I was going to think about here that, hello. I'll make you dizzy yet. That when we look at sort of Old Testament times, actually all the way through probably the empire of the Greeks, what did those empires consider this little land to be? Something really important as far as people and political goes? Or were they just considered just a small speck in an empire that covered so many other places? I think you'll see is that whereas the people in the land of Canaan seem to be a thorn in the side of Nebuchadnezzar or name me an Assyrian king. I can't think of one now. One of the Assyrian kings or one of the Grecian kings or something like that. And as far as they were concerned, in their grand scheme of political things, that's all they were, is just a little thorn in the side. And probably if you talked about these people from Israel way up here in Greece somewhere, they'd say, who? And they just, even though we have studied them and their history has been written since, as it were, the beginning of time, they were not a political entity of note when the other empires started growing around here. They were just a thorn in the side. But now when the Romans come along, it appears that now Palestine has become more than just a thorn in the side. They're become worthy of actually taking a lot of Rome's time and effort to make sure that they're held under control. But still, when it comes to the fact that Rome owned the entire Mediterranean area and much more than that, we realize that still, this little bitty point of land right here was not much compared to what they had. But they realized that it was an important place, but as far as they were concerned, it wasn't important politically. However, as the Lord's people began to grow and to move out and to themselves become, start moving away from what started out to be the center of the Lord's kingdom, now moving out in every direction and preaching the gospel, now it appears that everybody knows who they are. When we look at some of the discussions about that were made about Paul here while he was in Asia Minor, see that this people say that he's, you know, disrupted the entire world. the gospel has gone out everywhere. So now all of a sudden, a little country where this gospel started has now become, the country itself reduces to insignificance, and the kingdom of God becomes something much bigger, and now starts to become even bigger than the Roman Empire. And we see as we go further in this lesson and probably on into lesson 46, that now it becomes more than just a nuisance to the Roman Empire. Because now we see that a little bit later than what we're talking about right now, that the Roman emperors start persecuting the Christians. Because now they've become a real pain in the neck to them. Now they realize who they are. Now it's not so much Israel that they're concerned about. Now it's the Christians that they're concerned about. But the Christians started out here in Israel. I was just listening while I was getting ready this morning, I have a CD of gospel music, a cappella music that I listen to. And after that, in my Windows Media Player, after it gets done with the last track, it goes into Homer Haley's discussion of the book of Revelation, that the gospel meeting that he had down in the 70s down in San Bernardino. And so he talks about the expansion of the gospel and how the people became persecuted. And so it just reminds me every time it goes into that there's been a big expansion of the area that we're looking at from just this little place. And we also realize that now this little place here as a place is not really that important anymore. In other words, people around me now still call it the Holy Land, but it is now no more holy than anything else. Though several of us have visited there and you know, say, wow, I've seen the place where Jesus stood and talked to people, or I saw the place where Paul stood and talked to other people. The fact of the matter is that as far as God is concerned, the whole world is holy. We look at the thing that reminded me about Brother Haley's discussion about that was that, you know, there's two sides as to when the book of Revelation was written, whether it was written before the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD or after its destruction in about 96 or something like that, when the persecutions of Domitian, I think, were coming about. And one has to wonder if one takes the early date that the book of Revelation was written before the destruction of Jerusalem, but it was written to people who were Christians who lived up here in Asia Minor, they would say, who cares about the destruction of Jerusalem? It, to me, anyway, it seems there would be no point to writing a book, that entire book, if it happened before the destruction of Jerusalem. But if we look at 96 AD, when this area is no longer really considered an important physical area anymore, and we look at the persecution of Christians, we can see that there's a story in the book of Revelation that points not only to their time, but to our time also. So it's one of the things is that as the gospel spread, what was it? Who was it that said this? John the Baptist said that. And this is going to be a real bad paraphrase. He says, I must get smaller, but he must get bigger. I must be less influential, and he must get more. I'm really slaughtering that. I think it was John the Baptist that mentioned that, because they were concerned, I think his disciples, John's disciples were concerned that this Jesus guy was drawing influence away from John the Baptist. And I think John the Baptist said, he must increase and I must decrease, if I recall that well. And so when we look at it, we realize that the physical entity of the land of Israel really is a historical thing to us now, and it must decrease while the, did you find it? While the global thing increases. Where is it?
John 3:30. He must increase, but I must decrease.
I finally got it. Yeah, and fumble around in the synapses enough, it'll eventually jiggle loose, right? So, yeah. So that's what I'm thinking here is that is one of the reasons now why we're becoming so global in view is because that's the purpose of the gospel, is to save everybody. Joey.
Well, in Revelation 1:9, John says he was on the island of Patmos when the revelation came.
Right.
And I thought it was, maybe I'm not remembering this correctly, but I thought it was historically documented that John was on Patmos, not anywhere near the 70s, but in the 90s.
Yeah.
Is
yeah.
that true? So doesn't that come down?
I think he died right around 100 or something like that.
So, but doesn't that come down?
I would think so.
In the 90s and not the 70s?
Yeah. I've never really read any of the books that have to do with the early date, even though I have a couple of them, and to see how they would explain that. Yeah, it does make sense that we certainly can place John at the end of his life, apparently, and he apparently died right near 100, as I recall, in that area. So
we know he was on Patmos. He says so in verse 9.
Right.
He was on Patmos when the Revelation came and he wrote the book.
It's a little island right here somewhere. Yeah. So, yeah. And he wrote it to these churches, these seven churches that were in Asia Minor. Now, if we look at that, and I don't want to get into this big discussion in the book of Revelation, but that's fun. the thing is that who made up the vast majority of the Christians in the churches of Asia Minor? When it comes to a religious viewpoint from a historical viewpoint, it's Gentiles, right? I hate to refer to Christians as Jews because they're not. They're Hebrews who are Christians, or they're former Jews who are Christians. There's a place, and I'd have to look it up, in one of the areas where Paul says, once again, I'm going to paraphrase this and murder it, you who were Gentiles. In other words, when you become a Christian, you're no longer a Gentile. But when you become a Christian, you're no longer a Jew. We have a tendency to say Jewish Christians just as an accommodative term to say, well, it's the people that used to be Jews that are now Christians. There's no such thing as a Jewish Christian. There's no such thing as a Gentile Christian. We're all Christians. Okay. What was I talking about? No idea. So it's the global view that we want to look at. And now it's sort of like taking this map and taking my mouse and zooming in and zooming out and zooming in and zooming out as far as the world view goes. That's interesting. It keeps rotating. That's really what the Bible story does for us. It zooms in for a while, and then we come out and we get a bigger picture. And then later on it zooms back in, and now we zoom back out and we get a world view picture now because the gospel has taken over, as it were. All right, on time. Oh, boy. Okay. Let me see. The major headings in the lesson that we had on the early problems, I think we discussed that somewhat in the last couple of weeks. If you look at in your book at the bottom, page 178, you'll see that there's a heading there about early problems. And we realize that at that time, even the most, you want to call them devout, or the apostles that were closest to Jesus or things like that, they still, for the longest time, felt that the kingdom would be what kind of kingdom? An earthly, physical kingdom. That Jesus would literally come back to this earth, and that he would literally reign on a throne in Jerusalem. And that'd be great. And that was one of the problems that the Jewish people had. But since most of the Christians that we read about in the early chapters of the book of Acts were formerly Jewish people, they had, of course, all these beliefs and understanding that had been taught to them over the generations, that this is the way it could. The authors in the book say that these people should have been the ones that most were able to understand that the kingdom that God was going to set up was not going to be a physical kingdom. These people should have known. But they apparently had sort of ulterior motives. James?
You know, to me, Richard, it's really interesting to note that in the Old Testament, you read the Jews, but then by the time you get to the New Testament, you have the Essenes, the Sadducees, the Pharisees. You see a shift from you just have Jews to now a very political system. Just a staunch change between Old and New Testament.
Yeah.
So no doubt, with all these different political sects and grabbing for power and synagogues and things, that they've got this big picture in their mind of Jesus coming back to earth and sitting on a throne here, and he's going to be on the biggest mountain on the earth, and we're going to be his people, and it's going to be like it was, and everything's going to be cool.
Yeah.
When Christ is trying to tell them that's not what this is about. But, you know, even though it took them a long time to get that point, we see a great deal of patience on the Lord's part working with them to get them to that point. And that's also a big lesson for us about when we're trying to teach folks, and obviously not talking about tolerating false doctrine or anything, but some people pick things up quicker than others, and when we're teaching people, patience is a key thing to get the truth across, and sometimes it just takes a while of learning and talking and thinking before that light bulb finally comes on with somebody.
Patience, I think, at least for me, one of the hardest things to accomplish. You know, you think, what kind of a stupid statement is that? And then you just go from there.
How can you not see that when it's so clear?
Right.
It's very clear
right.
to us, but especially people coming out of denominational backgrounds, there's so much fundamental thinking that you have to help them change. You've got to pour their cup out, and they have to refill it with something different. And that can be a challenge.
And we've all seen that. How many times have we been talking to our children or to our parents, or been talking to other people about the Lord or something like that, and we make a statement and they come back with something and we realize we have to take 5 steps back. They don't understand. We take that 5 steps back and start going and teaching from another point of view or another area and realize that from what they said, we need to take another 5 steps back. You know, I think one of the things that I've noticed whenever I've gone out with Mickey and trying to talk to people who set up appointments with him, that he starts at Genesis chapter 1. A lot of times, if you don't do that, you're not able to establish where your common basis is. And he's told the story a couple of times about a neighbor that we had on my block that we went out to visit. And we studied with him for a number of weeks and finally came to the conclusion that the only book of the entire New Testament that he would accept was like the book of Mark. You know, the more we talk to him, the more he'd reject. And it's like we have to go back and we have to establish. And then as we would establish this, he would reject that also. He rejected anything that had to do with the apostle Paul because he felt apparently that he was some sort of false teacher. And so anybody that was infected with the Apostle Paul, that book couldn't be trusted. And so we ended up with, out of the 27 books of the New Testament, I think only one that he would believe. And so finally we asked him, well, then why don't you just become a Jew? And he says, I'm thinking about it. So I don't know. It's strange. The people have their beliefs. I have a co-worker that I work with now, and we were out at lunch the other day with another co-worker, and we were out at In-N-Out Burger, and of course on the bottom of the cup, you know, they've got a scripture reference. So this one of them says John 3:16. The other one had something in the Psalms or something like that, and so that started off a quasi-religious discussion there in In-N-Out Burger, And but this other coworker that I was with, he's a very premillennial kind of guy, and he makes statements that are like, well, yeah, when the 1,000-year reign comes, it's like, and this is going to be, and he's stating it in a statement of fact, and you think, oh boy, if I jump into this now, we're going to be here for the next 3 hours discussing the book of Revelation. We'll have to order more hamburgers. So it's difficult many times to, as you say, have the patience that you need to realize where I need to step back and where I need to stand in order to teach the gospel, because it needs to be taught with patience. Because if we don't teach it with patience, we just say, well, you're not baptized, therefore you're going to hell. Bye. That doesn't help a lot. Really, it doesn't. So, okay, next time, hopefully my rambling will be less, but let's go into the questions. If you haven't gotten one of the question sheets, there's still a few more up here. I did email them out, as I say, in the early day yesterday. So if you've got it, please get those done.